The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, a team of researchers uses lasers to unveil tattoos on ancient Peruvian mummies. And modern 3D imaging technology is being used to uncover dinosaurs' diets and how they changed hundreds of millions of years ago. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Researchers are using laser technology to illuminate the preserved skin of Peruvian mummies, revealing tattoo designs 1,200 years old. Tom Kay, a researcher from the Foundation for Scientific Advancement in Sierra Vista, Arizona, was part of a team that is literally shedding new light on Peru's Chancay civilization. The Chancay people lived in a coastal area of Peru before the expansion and rise of the Inca Empire. Tom's team examined about 100 mummies, revealing complex geometric tattoos. The research was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America. I spoke with Tom Kay to learn more.
We had absolutely nothing to do with mummies or ancient people before this. Most of our published papers are in paleontology, where we made discoveries on fossils. But our technique has been so groundbreaking in the last 10 years that word has gotten around into other places, and we started branching out into archaeology because we thought, you know, this is an underutilized technique, and we may be able to make some splashes in that field. So we were invited to go to Peru by this researcher, Judita Bach, who had been there for 8 years studying these mummies, and she had not made much progress, so we came in with our technique, and we really kind of knocked it out of the box.
What can you tell me about this, I won't say the full word, this LSF technique and what it actually does?
Yeah, that stands for laser-stimulated fluorescence. So most people have had the experience of taking a UV flashlight or something and shining it around the room. And when you do that, certain things light up very brightly. Well, when you use a laser to do that, the intensity of the laser is greater than your UV flashlight. So the fluorescence is even brighter. And what happens is things that do not fluoresce very much under the flashlight will fluoresce strongly under the laser, and we see new things that even people with the flashlight did not see. So that's what got us going. We had no idea when we went to look at the mummies whether or not this would work, and this is kind of how we do things. We show up, we try everything, and see what pops out.
I guess a way to think about it is, so you are putting a mummy or a preserved body part, essentially, and shining this light through it, and it's revealing, in this case, tattoos, artwork. Why was this artwork previously not as visible before shining this light into it?
So that's a great question. You know, what did our technique show that other techniques didn't? So you can actually see the tattoos on these mummies. And these mummies are not like Egyptian mummies where they took great care in preparing them and wrapping them in cloth and all that. The Peruvian mummies, when people died, they'd wrap them in clothing and they'd put the entire body up on top of a mountain away from predators, and the body would just desiccate out. So you basically have leather over bones in most of these mummies. You can see the tattoos, but what our breakthrough was when we shine the laser on the skin underneath the tattoo lights up like a light bulb. And that shines light from the inside out through the tattoo. So if you've ever had a pencil drawing on a piece of paper and you put the drawing down on the desk, face down, you can't see the pencil drawing very well. If you pick that piece of paper up and you put a light bulb behind that piece of paper, even though the drawing's on the other side of the paper, it becomes quite evident what's drawn on the other side of the paper. So that's what happened. And in this case, we all know that tattoos bleed over time and you can't see the original artwork. When we use this fluorescence, laser-stimulated fluorescence, It eliminated the bleed, and we could see the original artwork, which was not visible because of the bleed. And that was the big breakthrough.
What about the artwork itself allowed it to keep up for 1,200 years, not fade, if you will?
Well, you know, that's a good question. Some of them do fade. Some of them are barely visible. Some of them are very visible. And, you know, we're kind of new to this game, so I can't really answer that. I don't know if anybody has studied that effect or not, but I'm not aware of any studies on that.
So, Tom, tell me a little bit about this artwork. What kinds of designs were you able to see and detect with this technology?
So we looked at hundreds of tattoos, and the designs were quite varied. It was not like they had the same logo, Nike logo, on every one of these tattoos. They were as varied as the individuals were from what we saw. The ones we examined in particular, one of them looked like fish scales. They had little triangles all next to each other and connected at the corners. Another one we looked at was on the hand, and it had a vine motif on it with kind of leaves coming off of it. And a third one we looked at was just on the knuckle of the finger, and it was just straight lines kind of very close together. So we didn't see anything that I could tell with my eye that was kind of an overarching theme from these tattoos, and they were quite varied.
And with the anthropologists that you worked with in this study, why is this significant? What does the artwork tell them about this culture that maybe is something that they previously hadn't known?
Well, we are looking at the width of the original lines now. By seeing the original artwork, we can see the fine detail that was originally implemented in the drawing. And when we measured these lines, we were kind of shocked to find out how fine they were. They were between 0.1 and 0.2 millimeters wide for some of the finest lines. And there were literally hundreds and hundreds of these very fine lines. And, you know, we're not 100% sure how they were made. Some researchers believe they were made by cuts. Other researchers might think they were made with a pointed needle. But they're so fine, it's a little enigmatic how they're made. So this is why this is leading edge research, because we don't have a clean answer to that question. That may be the next phase of our research.
And that's a great next question is where will you take this technology next with mummies or other subjects?
Well, what you want to do when you have a new technique like this is, now that we know it works, right? When we went to Peru, we had no idea if it was going to show anything at all. Now we know that it does work. So now you've kind of got to qualify it and say, okay, where does it work and where doesn't it work and what can it tell us? So because of the publicity we've gotten from this last article, we now have access to medical researchers who are researching actual skin, human skin, fresh human skin. And we may have the ability then to go use this technique on fresh human skin and then do something like desiccate it down to the level of the mummies and see how it changes and what happens. So that's kind of our thinking, is where we'll go next.
I wonder if there could be research that would benefit criminal justice investigations in this case. It's just something that comes to me, forensic investigations and identification purposes.
That's a very good question, and we're not sure. The first thing I can think of offhand is that if you had a tattoo, which are highly identifiable in forensics cases, and you had it removed, so that means most of the ink has been taken away from the surface, at least the surface of the skin. I'm not sure, but it may be possible that if we shine the laser, we may be able to bring back the tattoo that's still deeply embedded under there, that's no longer visible from the surface. We may still be able to detect it. So if someone tried to escape justice by having their tattoos removed, we may be able to fix that problem.
Do you think that any of the designs that you were able to unveil might catch on and end up in a tattoo shop one day in the 21st century?
You know, that's a cultural phenomenon. Tattoos are certainly a cultural phenomenon. I can tell you, though, that of all the tattoos we looked at and all the tattoos I've seen on people walking around the streets, I didn't see any that related to each other. Most of the stuff that we saw in Peru was some type of a geometric design. And if I had to hazard a guess, I would say most of the things I've seen on the street are more picturesque, more pictures of something. So I don't think that today's people are going to go back to just a geometric design on their bodies, as that would be my personal opinion. That's certainly not a scientific opinion.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for taking the time. Anything else that you'd like to add that you think we're missing?
Well, we think this is an interesting new area. Mummies have had a long history in human culture leading up to today. So we're looking forward to potentially unveiling new interesting ideas, new interesting things about the tattoos using our technique. And we hope to be talking to you in the future when we make those discoveries.
I'm looking forward to hearing about them. Thanks so much for taking the time. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you very much.
Tom Kay is a researcher from the Foundation for Scientific Advancement in Sierra Vista, Arizona. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. This is the best of our knowledge. You can learn a lot about an animal from what it ate. Same goes for creatures that roamed the Earth hundreds of millions of years ago. Scientists are using 3D scanning technology to examine fossilized dinosaur poo, called coprolites, to examine what dinosaurs ate, giving us clues about what the Earth was like in a distant era. Preserved dino droppings from the Triassic period in present-day Poland were found to contain the remains of insects, fish, and mollusks. To learn more, I spoke with Martin Kvardstrom, a researcher at the Evolutionary Biology Center in Uppsala University in Sweden.
It was kind of a stepwise thing. So I started looking at coprolites, so fossil poop, just to because I was curious and we wanted to see what they contained. And it turned out that they contained so much information on the diets of these animals that we just thought that, hey, if we look at a lot of coprolites from the same particular place, we could probably reconstruct the food web. And then step by step, the project just became bigger and bigger. And in the end, it became into this really big project. So it's not something that I anticipated when we started off looking at coprolites, but it just grew by itself.
So when we're talking about this fossilized poo, when you say that we can learn a lot, does it look pretty similar to how dinosaur poo might look today? What does it actually look like when someone finds something like this?
Yeah, so that depends a lot. They come in all sorts of like shapes and sizes. So we have to remember here that we've looked at droppings from not just dinosaurs, but all the animals that shared the ecosystems with the dinosaurs. So everything from like tiny droppings from fish, just a few millimeter wide, to real big chunks of feces from big dinosaurs. So some of them look like you could imagine just like something that a dog has left behind, you know, in a park, but fossilized, so nowadays a rock. And some specimens are bigger, smaller, and yeah, all sorts of sizes and shapes.
Now, how well preserved are the materials that are inside? Obviously, these objects are millions, hundreds of millions of years old. So when you see something like a seed or fossilized plant matter inside one of these objects, what does it actually look like?
That's a really interesting question, actually, because you would think that it's gone through the whole digestive tract of the animal that ate them, that it wouldn't preserve that well in the dropping. But it's on the contrary, they're really beautifully preserved often. So in fact, the fossils we find within these coprolites are 3D preserved really often. And if something survived the digestion of the animal that ate them, we can find really, really cool fossils in these coprolites. So we see tiny insects and even soft tissues sometimes preserved.
Do you sometimes find materials that look similar to maybe seeds or plant matter or something that still exists on Earth today?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, if we look at a lot of the plants that were around there, so a lot of ferns, they look very similar to what they look like today. But of course, when we see plant matter in the coprolites from herbivorous dinosaurs, they're just like tiny small fragments. So we have to look at the cuticles, so really under the microscope to have an idea from what type of plants they come from. So it's not large chunks of the plants; it's rather small residues.
So beyond looking at objects, these objects under a microscope, how else do scientists like yourself determine what dinosaurs actually ate in these coprolites?
So we use synchrotron microtomography. It's a bit of like the core method in our paper, I would say. And it's a bit like using a CT scanner at the hospital, but with thousands times as much energy. So we could really look at fine details within these coprolites, so a micrometer scale. And we need that kind of power because the whole chunk is fossilized, right? So it's a lump of rock that we want to look at small contrast. So basically, what we can do with these scans is that we can reconstruct everything that is inside these coprolites in 3D. And this was completely impossible before when we just, cut coprolites into pieces and we just got some random 2D sections. And it was really hard to tell what they contain. And it's still kind of hard to understand what all those bits and pieces are. But at least we can visualize them in 3D, which helps a lot. Although I would also say it's pretty time consuming to segment all of that.
Is it possible to identify the kind of animal or dinosaur by their droppings that have been fossilized and in the earth for hundreds of millions of years?
Yes, but it's pretty difficult. So what we do is that we try to analyze as many different kinds of droppings as we can find from one particular place, and then we try to match these different groups based on shape and contents and size and so on to the animals we know from that particular site, so from the same ecosystem. And in fact, in most cases, we get it pretty accurate, and sometimes it's very, very easy. We see the teeth from the producer of the coprolites are crushed and found inside the coprolites, for example. Or we can use various aspects of shape, such as if they're spiral, they're from an animal with a spiral gut, and so on. So there are a few different tools at hand, but it's a lot of detective work.
And when comparing different examples from different eras, does that give you a picture of what animals lived in what eras or how animal diets changed over time?
That's it. So we're looking at how diets change over time and see how feeding strategies differ, how the food webs are changing through time. We can see, for example, when dinosaurs are becoming more dominant, that the carnivores, the terrestrial carnivores, are not feeding on fish so much anymore, but on other land animals. So we can see trends and changes in diets, but also, the whole structure of the ecosystem.
So you're essentially seeing how dinosaurs, animals that no longer exist on Earth, changed over a long time. When we talk about the change, how many millions of years of coprolites are you comparing here?
Yeah, so we've looked at a key interval, which is 30 million years long. So it's from 230 to 200 million years ago, approximately. And we do so because we know that this is the time from when we get the first dinosaurs until they're completely dominant. So we targeted this time interval, and we have a number of different sites in this restricted geographical setting that span this interval. So we have five different assemblages, more sites, but five different assemblages that are sort of timestamps across these 30 million years. But of course, they're just windows into 30 million years of evolution. That's a lot of time, but they're quite telling anyway.
What was Earth like 200 million years ago?
Yeah, so all the continents were still assembled in this big supercontinent, Pangaea, that was sort of a C-shaped supercontinent that spread from the north to the south. And it was, yeah, the landmass was separated by climatic barriers, probably big deserts that were impossible to cross for some of these dinosaurs. And So we had different faunas in different part of the world at this time. And towards the end of the Triassic, so approaching the Jurassic period some 200 million years ago, Pangaea is starting to break up. This when the Atlantic, the beginning of the Atlantic Ocean begins to form. And there is a lot of volcanism associated with that and a lot of climate change. So we have a changing climate from a more dry, hot Triassic into a more humid and sort of nice Jurassic period.
Now, is there evidence from these coprolites that dinosaurs changed in shape during this time period? Did they get larger? Did they get smaller? What happened?
So yeah, we haven't only looked at the coprolites, but also the body fossils, so the skeletons and but also the tracks from these sites. And definitely, dinosaurs are becoming larger. They're becoming more abundant. They're becoming more diverse. So we have various different types of dinosaurs. The first ones in this area, they were just small, opportunistic animals eating all sorts of things. But towards the Jurassic, towards the end of this time interval that we're focusing on here, we've already have the major lines of dinosaurs, the long-necked herbivore dinosaurs and the carnivores doing all sorts of different things. So yeah, there's definitely a diversity increase throughout this time.
Do any of these clues from this research paint a picture of what these dinosaurs may have actually looked like? By examining what a dinosaur may have eaten, does that change maybe if you had an illustration or a model of a dinosaur, how it might actually look with its muscular structure or something else?
Oof, yeah, that's a complicated question, actually. I wouldn't say so, not that much, but I would flip the question almost, because if we have the skeleton of an animal, we can say so much, but not everything about that animal as a living being. So we can of course guess, what a dinosaur might have eaten and so on, and what kind of life it was living, but we don't actually see that much of the living animal, just the dead remains of it. So by looking at the coprolites, which are left behind of the actual living animals, we get more a bigger picture of diet, but also physiology. We know how it digested food and so on, so we can tell more about the animals.
So where does this research lead you next? What's the next thing you need to uncover?
Also now, I think because this was such a new thing to try, it would be really cool to test the model that we've now proposed over the stepwise rise of dinosaurs in other regions of the world. Because we looked at one region in the northern part of Pangaea, so it would be amazing to test this model on other places. And we now know that it's pretty time-consuming and it requires a lot of effort, but it would be really cool to look at other important sites with early dinosaurs.
And will you be doing any traveling as part of this research?
I mean, I would love to. Let's see what happens next, but it would be great.
Well, Martin, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it. Anything else you think people need to know?
Thank you, Lucas. Well, I guess one thing I could add that is, I mean, of course, it might sound like a simple study, but it requires so much work and big collaboration. So we're a lot of scientists working together, and I think this is a really nice part for me. We were paleobotanists focusing on the fossil plants, and vertebrate paleontologists, geochemists looking at the chemical composition. So we've assembled a lot of different types of evidence into one big picture, which I think is a cool part of this study.
Absolutely. Martin, again, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lucas.
Martin Kvarnström is a researcher at the Evolutionary Biology Center at Uppsala University in Sweden. His team's research that used 3D scanning technology to study fossilized dinosaur droppings is published in the journal Nature. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Thank you. On the next episode of The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll learn how artificial intelligence technology is helping researchers develop anti-venom for snake bite victims. We'll speak with Susana Vasquez-Torres, a recent graduate student from the Baker Lab, about her work with machine learning.
Right now, the most effective treatments that are being used in the clinic are like antidotes that are purified from the serum of immunized animals. So basically, there's a trick where you expose these animals, like horses, to some small amount of whole venom of some snake species that is medically relevant, and you wait some time for the immune system of the animal to raise antibodies. But the thing is that the immune system is very smart, so it can develop a specific antibodies for each one of these components. So it makes like a complex mixture of polyclonal antibodies that target each one or most of the toxic components. So this is very effective, but of course this technology has a lot of problems. And we think like these new methods that we describe in the paper could help in this process or to make treatments more effective and more accessible.
Hear more on the next episode of The Best of Our Knowledge. If you'd like to tell The Best of Our Knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to The Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes to hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1793. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.